Robin Young, it's here and now. Two pressing issues in Washington today. President Bush released portions of a national intelligence report which point to Iraq as a cause célèbre for terrorists. And lawmakers are rushing to finish legislation this week, including a terrorism detainee bill. And there's apparently been a move to question the basis of the bill, whether or not detainees should be held indefinitely without charge. Let's go to that discussion first. Earlier today, we spoke with Democratic Senator John Kerry. Here's a part of that exchange. As you know, there's been a lot of debate about methods of interrogation and the use of harsh interrogation or torture, a lot of debate about whether detainees should see the evidence against them that might have classified material. Hardly any debate on whether the U.S. should even consider legislating the detention of suspected terrorists indefinitely. Why hasn't there been more outrage, especially from the Democrats?
Debate. Actually, we're going to have an amendment on the floor of the Senate today to empower habeas corpus to be applied. That is the right to be able to petition for why you are being detained and to have a right of access to the court so that it is not a detention that is forever. In addition to that, many of us believe that there ought to be a confrontation of the evidence. Obviously, it's un-American, and we don't do that.
What do you say, though, to people who have said that the Democrats have been sitting on the sidelines on this issue because they don't want to be seen as soft on security running up to the midterms?
I don't think that's accurate. I think you've heard plenty of us be very critical, but the fight was fundamentally between members of the Republican Party. Now that some of those members seem to have accepted a compromise that a lot of us feel has some problems with it, you're going to see a broader debate than there was, but it wasn't necessary.
We feel we hadn't heard anyone question whether or not people should be detained, period, putting aside torture or the use of evidence.
Well, if you capture people who are engaged in activities, plotting or otherwise, you have to detain them and hold people accountable.
But don't you have to charge them?
Well, at some point, you have to charge them. That's why you have the habeas corpus argument that's taking place now.
We'll have more of that talk with Senator Kerry in just a moment. But keeping with the issue of detainee rights, let's turn to reporter Gail Chadwick, who covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, what's going on here? Because earlier this week, you told us you were astonished when this issue of habeas corpus first came up, only at a hearing on Monday. What's happening?
Well, it is the element that has been just quietly swept aside. It will come up, I hope, today, not on the House floor. The House has forbidden all amendments on their bill, but the Senate will bring it up. But the reason you heard Senator Kerry when he just spoke, that was a very interesting interview. What he did not tell you was that Democrats were going to draw a line in the sand on this, try to filibuster the bill, block it. It isn't even a caucus vote. That is, that's when Democrats say to each other, look, this is critical for the team. We all rally together on this. This is a must vote for us. In fact, when pressed about this yesterday, the Democratic leader, Harry Reid, said that this will come up in amendment. But he said, we all want to make sure that these bad people are brought to justice.
Again, that question of nobody wants to be seen as being soft on terrorism. So you're saying that what are you saying? This might be for show? They're not really going to be willing to go the mile for it?
Oh, I think that people really are concerned about it, but they are not going to make it a showstopper. No one at this point in time wants to risk a sort of dirty, hairy moment when someone is released that could be dangerous to the country.
Well, and meanwhile, you heard this issue brought up in a committee hearing with Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter. Do we understand that he now says he wants to offer an amendment that would simply delete the provision stripping detainees of any habeas corpus rights? Is that the same amendment?
Same thing. Democrats are talking about the same thing. But it's interesting, Lindsey Graham, one of the three Republicans who's been compromising with the White House on this bill, has predicted that that amendment will fall on a broad bipartisan vote. I suspect he has his ears to the ground on it, and he's hearing what I'm hearing, that Democrats are not going to kind of fight to the last moment on this one. They'll make the objection, but they won't block the bill over it.
But as you write today, you're hearing from law experts who say, you know, the habeas corpus right is sort of the bulwark
It is
of American law.
It's fundamental. It's very interesting. You even have many conservatives who are standing up against this provision because they see it as so absolutely fundamental to jurisprudence. This goes back to the Great Writ. This goes back to the Magna Carta. Nothing more fundamental than the idea that the king can't just throw you into a deep dungeon forever. And it's interesting, when you listen to the debate, Representative Cole on the House floor today said, you know, we're giving these killers the presumption of innocence. Well, are they killers? That's what habeas corpus hearings, they look at the basic evidence for detainment. And it's hard, given all the fear around this issue, to keep in mind that innocence until proven guilty is fundamental.
And yet it may not be a part of a new law. Gail Chadwick, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, we'll keep on top of this with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to the declassification of parts of the National Intelligence Estimate. The portions of the report that are now public assert the Iraq war is fueling jihadists around the world, but the Bush White House claims the report also points to successes in their policies. President Bush released 4 pages of the report after portions had been leaked. Well, earlier today, as we said, we spoke with Democratic Senator John Kerry, a critic of the war. We asked if he'd seen the full report.
I'm seeing it this afternoon.
Well, of what you've seen of the 4 pages, your thoughts?
I think it states what it states. Everybody knows that there's been some disruption of certain levels of the al-Qaeda network and others. But on the other hand, they have created more terrorists. They are serving as a huge recruitment. Iraq is setting us backwards, not forwards, period.
Well, as you know, the report has one line that the Bush administration has been seizing on. The line reads, should jihadists leaving Iraq perceive themselves and be perceived to have failed, we judge fewer fighters will be inspired to carry on the fight, meaning around the world. The Bush administration says that line underscores their feeling that it's important that the U.S. win in Iraq and in so doing force out jihadists.
The debate is not over whether or not we ought to be successful. The debate is over how you are successful. How you are successful. This administration is creating more terrorists, is getting deeper into a civil war, and they're not on a success path. They're saying, stay the course, stay the course, stay the course. Stay the course is a recipe for disaster. What you need is to redeploy our troops, give them a date, begin to tell them they've got to stand up for themselves, complete the training, resolve the political differences, and get our troops out, who are, in fact, a magnet for terrorism.
Well, will that be a signal of defeat, which is what the Bush administration
says? No, it's a signal of success. It's getting smart. It's exactly what we need to do to send the message to the terrorists. We know how to fight you more effectively than this stupid way where they're just sending troops out to get blown up by improvised explosive devices.
Senator, why does the Democratic Party seem to be split on this? As you well know, there are many Democrats, many who were against the war, who wished you had voted against the war initially. You've heard from them. We've had this conversation before. Who are now saying we need to stay to fix a broken country. They say it's not foreign jihadists who are causing these violent images promoting jihad around
That's
the world.
Correct.
It's sectarian violence. Yeah, and if the U.S. pulls out,
Look,
as you're calling for it, it'll be a bloodbath.
The only way to resolve a civil war is to resolve the issues over which that civil war is being fought. The fact is that the Shia and the Sunni have fundamental differences that are not being addressed. If you resolve those differences, I'll tell you this, point blank, the jihadists will not stay in Iraq because the Iraqis don't want them.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, we spoke with him earlier today. Well, we turn now to Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And Peter, you write today that this debate is becoming the main issue of the midterm campaign. We heard from Senator Kerry. What is the White House saying? We know they're claiming that portions of this report validate the policies of going to war in Iraq. Do you see that?
Well, I see that the White House feels that, certainly. I mean, they're pretty confident. I guess I should confident may not be the right word here, but they feel okay about this election being decided on national security. There's not a lot of issues that Republicans are doing well on right now, but the one issue where they think that they have an advantage, and certainly in a rhetorical sense over the next 6 weeks, where they feel that they will be able to clearly articulate a difference between Republicans and Democrats, they feel that this issue does work in their advantage.
But how do they square that with this report saying that Iraq has spawned this jihadist terrorist movement around the world and spawned more terrorists than less?
Well, one could ask how they can square that strategy with the rising death toll in Iraq, the fact that that it's clearly not going the way that they had intended. You know, the kind of through it all, the White House still feels that they have one big, huge advantage here, which is that the Democrats don't have a coherent strategy for getting out. Now, you just talked to Senator Kerry. I mean, it's interesting to hear him. You know, he's clearly critical of the way the Bush administration has handled Iraq. But when you asked him for what the Democratic Party might stand for, he kind of read off a list of tell them to get their troops together. We need to pull our troops out. They need to get everything working straight. The jihadists will go home. Well, that's not necessarily different than what the White House is saying.
To be fair, Senator Kerry, that was an excerpt, and Senator Kerry also went on to say that there should be more attention on diplomacy, on bringing these disparate groups, the Shiites and the Sunnis, together and trying to figure out what the differences are between them and patch that up. He did speak more about that, but I hear your point. We understand as well that the White House is claiming that at least a part of the report points to one of their successes, because the report, this estimate of, what, 16 spy agencies, was written back in April, and it said that, for instance, if the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq was removed, it would go a great distance to ending some of the jihadist movement in that country, and he was.
Yes, and so the White House is pointing to that as a measure of what they feel is some degree of progress, and they're also saying that on the one hand, this report makes the argument that that the Iraq War has become the cause célèbre of jihadists, but on the other hand, they feel that it kind of paints a picture of a disaster should the United States pull out or be viewed as having lost the war in Iraq. But, you know, on the flip side, in terms of the politics of this, the last few days we've really seen the Democrats, despite their division on Iraq, they have begun, you have seen a bit more energy toward criticizing the Bush administration, not just about the war in Iraq, but on the broader foreign policy.
And, well, of course, you write about President Clinton's recent involvement in his interview on Fox. And some would say that really energized the base and was long overdue. And your colleague David Sanger writes in the Times today that the questions raised by the report are would have postponing a confrontation with Saddam Hussein focused instead on securing Afghanistan and finding Osama bin Laden. But why aren't we hearing more Democrats with that passion that we heard from President Clinton?
Well, again, there has been a traditional hesitancy by the Democrats to engage on national security because of that division that they've had on Iraq, and also because there's a perception that national security is a trap set by the Republicans, that it only benefits Republicans, that Democrats are too easily painted as soft on terror, soft on terrorists, et cetera, and that is, in fact, what the Republicans are now trying to do with this kind of list of pieces of legislation that they're at least debating in this last week of Congress before they recess for the elections, in terms of the wiretapping and the detainee legislation. Those are all issues that are in a way designed, in addition to the policy implications, are designed to try to paint Democrats as soft. Now, this intelligence report could give Democrats something to cling on to there as they try to formulate, to formulate their message.
Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, also co-author of the new book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century, a look at the strategy you've just been telling us about. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
And we'll keep an eye on everything going on in Washington today. But meanwhile, much more coming up here and now. Stay with us. It's Here and Now.
Now, I know it is customary in Pakistan to offer tea to a guest for hospitality's sake, so I have brought you, this is a jasmine green tea.
Thank you very much.
May I pour?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, sir. Do you recognize?
Very thoughtful of you.
Is this a tea that is recognizable to you?
Yeah, it is.
Is it
Urdu.
It's good.
Yeah.
Is it a bargain tea? Have I insulted you in any way?
No, you didn't.
It's a good tea.
But it is good tea.
I've also... this is an American delicacy. It's called a Twinkie.
A bit of The Daily Show. The gentleman you hear laughing, Jon Stewart's guest last night, Pakistan's president, Pervez Musharraf, who seems to be on as much of a book tour as a policy visit to the U.S. Last night, Musharraf diplomatically took his tea with a Twinkie with Jon Stewart. Tonight, he dines at the White House with Presidents Bush and Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan. Joining us to talk about this Pakistani president's visit is Adil Najam, professor of international negotiation and diplomacy at Tufts University's Fletcher School. Adil, of course, welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much.
What do you, just your overriding thought of President Musharraf's visit? It's been kind of an odd one, frankly, you know, announcing at a press conference with the president that he had a serious comment to make about the run-up to the war in Afghanistan, but he couldn't talk more about it because he had a book deal with Simon & Schuster, and now, you know, paying a visit to the Jon Stewart Show.
It is. General Musharraf all the time, all over, everywhere, and it's as much of a book tour as it is a policy tour. He obviously sees himself as the image of Pakistan, and I think in his mind, you know, one of the things he's been pushing very hard for the last 6 months is this thing he calls Brand Pakistan. So I think in his mind, it's part of that. It's putting a different face to Pakistan, but it's caused a lot of comments back in Pakistan and here about where the line is between a state visit and a book tour.
Right, Brand Pakistan. Tell us more about that. Does he think Pakistan has a problem with its public relations?
Don't you?
Well, let's detail them.
I think many Pakistanis, and certainly General Musharraf, believes that Pakistan gets a bad rap, that it as soon as you hear Pakistan, what you think of is extremism, terrorism, and that there is, you know, a softer side to Sears, and there's also a softer side to Pakistan.
Well, and meanwhile, he's being accused of backing down to potential people who are helping Osama bin Laden in part of his country. He's been seen as actually helping the Taliban as they make more incursions into Afghanistan. He does have a few things to smooth over.
Yes, and you know, despite all the Twinkie and the tea, there is some very serious text in these conversations, both for General Musharraf and for the people asking the questions, because this is a tough time for General Musharraf, both internationally and domestically. Probably the toughest he has had ever since he has been in power. So you see sort of, you know, him smiling, and he enjoys this, but he has come here with a very serious message, part of which is in response to the question you asked, where his argument is that we have not made a deal with Taliban, we've made a deal against Taliban. He keeps repeating that sentence.
Meaning what?
Meaning that he has made a deal with these tribal elders in these areas. On the assumption that since the government forces haven't been able to do much because of the terrain and because of the political situation, maybe this innovative approach of dealing directly with the community there and getting them on board to help in reducing the tensions might help. Now, that's a very controversial
move. Right. And meanwhile, President Karzai accused Pakistan recently of using the Taliban to maintain power over Afghanistan, some would say to sort of deflect any influence of India. But what do you think is going to happen tonight at dinner?
I think this dinner, unlike the Twinkie last night, is a very important dinner, and maybe one of the most important meetings that these three men, President Bush, President Karzai, President Musharraf, have had. And they've had a lot of very important meetings with each other because there is, I think, a very, very serious problem brewing up in this sparring between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I don't think either country can afford it. I don't think the world can afford it. And it is getting to a level where there is a real danger that it might get beyond just words. Right? If you look, President Karzai is also in the U.S., and he's been doing the talk circuit. And both of them have actually started making it more personal, in some ways trying to deflect the problems they have each at home by blaming the other.
When you say that it might get much more serious, what are you thinking?
Well, right now they're saying, so President Musharraf's argument is that the issue is Talibanization, and therefore it is Afghanistan's issue and President Karzai's issue. President Karzai's take on this is that, no, the issue is this area called Waziristan along the border, and the problems of Talibanization we are seeing in Afghanistan are really coming from across the border, right? So there's this finger-pointing. Now, imagine for a moment that these two single most important allies we have in that region, the single most important allies in the war on terror, who are just now, right now, only bad-mouthing each other. Mm. If the tensions escalate, just imagine what would that mean. You have a nuclear power on one hand.
Pakistan.
You have a country with where the government at Kabul is barely in control of, you know, much of the country. And imagine if it blows up into, you know, it'll take one rogue guy pulling a bullet wrongly, or an extremist trying to sort of spur it by an incident, and in the middle of it you have U.S. forces, a large number. Who do we choose to go with? So this is, I think, in some ways, President Bush's diplomatic moment. This is the type of preemption we want, for him to step in tonight at this dinner and say, guys, okay, it's time to get serious.
Yeah. Well, Adil Najam, professor of international negotiation and diplomacy at Tufts University's Fletcher School, very serious topic, and thank you so much for joining us to talk about it. We're going to leave our listeners, though, with a lighter moment from last night's Daily Show. Here is, again, Pervez Musharraf.
Let's say if there were an election held in Pakistan today, and not clearly for your job, because you're doing a wonderful job, for, let's say, the mayoralty of Karachi or ombudsman or something, and we put up two candidates, George W. Bush and Osama bin Laden, be truthful, who would win a popular vote in Pakistan?
I think they'll both lose miserably.
Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Here are some recent headlines you might have missed. Sewage spill closes Laguna Beach shoreline in Southern California. Massive sewage spill shuts down Wisconsin beaches. Or in Maryland, sewage spill enters Wicomico River. These stories aren't isolated. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency reported 73,000 sewage spills across the country just last year. Tom Rooney is president and CEO of InstuForm Technologies. The company repairs sewer pipes around the world. He joins us from St. Louis, Missouri. And Tom, how big is the sewage pipeline problem?
It's a very serious problem, and it's a very serious problem in the United States and even globally. The issue stems from the fact that sewer pipes are underground and out of sight and out of mind. And I think most people would think that they'll last forever, concrete pipes underground, and they just don't. They last typically 50 years. They're typically the most expensive asset that any municipality has, believe it or not. And they're in a horrible state of disrepair right now.
Right. And how many towns can repair them all? And I'm betting that they all went in about 50 years ago.
That's right, because the housing industry boom after World War II, which is, of course, 60 years ago now, and when suburbia grew up in America, the vast majority of the sewer infrastructure throughout the United States was put into place between 40 and 60 years ago, and so all of that is now coming due right now. And because it's been out of sight, it hasn't been maintained, to be quite frank.
Well, we began thinking of this when BP temporarily shut down one of its major oil fields in the Prudhoe Bay in Alaska last month after discovering that pipes there were corroding. You say that that's nothing compared to the problems that can be caused by sewer pipes. Really? Because, of course, we think of oil as being the thing that costs the most.
Right. And I think people look at oil as a toxic element on pristine Alaskan tundra and huge environmental damage and so on. But that really is one almost spill, by the way. It wasn't an actual spill. Mm-hmm. A couple of months earlier, they had a spill. But to your point from earlier, there have been 73,000 sewer spills of late. And, you know, lately in the news, there's been so much about spinach and people opening bags of spinach and becoming sick and dying from E. coli. Well, E. coli is what is in sewage, and the most prolific spread of E. coli in the world comes from poor sewer systems. Unfortunately, people are not connecting the dots between 50-year-old pipes that are leaking everywhere, the EPA reporting record numbers of sewer spills, incidental things like spinach becoming tainted and killing people. There was a sewage spill in Hawaii just recently this year, 50 million gallons on Waikiki Beach that actually killed someone.
Yes, in that case, a 34-year-old man died after falling into sewage-contaminated waters on the beaches and contracting a flesh-eating bacterial infection. His family blamed the polluted water, but a medical examiner's report noted that he'd also had some other medical problems, so we want to note that. But let's step back. Explain to us what happens when there are cracks in sewer pipes. Some people would say, well, doesn't the water just seep back into the ground?
Yeah, sewer pipes are not under pressure. A drinking water pipe has pressure, and so it fires drinking water outside of a leak in a pipe. In fact, what happens with the sewer pipe when it cracks and breaks up is that it starts collecting rainwater and groundwater in very large volumes. And so what happens is the sewage treatment facilities that are supposed to treat sewage during a rain event start treating 10 to 100 times the amount, and it can't do it. And so whether you're talking about the Great Lakes or the oceans or whatnot, sewage treatment facilities have to open floodgates, and they just flood areas with raw sewage because they can't treat rainwater and sewage. So places where the raw sewage is put out is also the places where we're swimming, surfing, fishing, and so on. There was a study out by Stanford and UCLA just this past year that suggests 1.5 million people became sick in California alone last year from raw sewage in the waters.
Well, and by the way, that Stanford study that you mentioned also attributed the bacteria in the water to animal waste, factories, pesticides, oil and metals deposited on city streets. But your point's taken. Of course, it was largely sewage as well. And the EPA has leveled some huge fines related to sewage spills in August 2004. The EPA and the city of Los Angeles came to a $2 billion settlement. In Northern Kentucky, a sanitation department paid $800 million. For discharging 1 billion gallons of raw sewage into the Ohio River. That was over 5 years. So, the government is on top of this, but I'm guessing you'd say not on top enough?
Well, 1972, the Clean Water Act would have suggested that none of this would be taking place by 1982. But what we've seen is regulation in 1972 begat fines in the 80s, and in the 90s, municipalities had just pretty much decided to pay the fines. It was cheaper to pay the fines than fix the pipes. So there are far more sewage discharges today than ever have been. And so on the one hand, money is being invested in the pipes. On the other hand, those billion-dollar price tags and fines that you're talking about are nothing compared to what the EPA is predicting between $400 billion and $1 trillion has to be spent in the United States alone.
That's trillion. We have to say that's trillion with a T.
With a T. We might think about fines that are millions or tens of millions of dollars. It pales by comparison to the $1 trillion that might have to be spent.
So what's the answer? What's going to happen? I know my town actually made a huge commitment and is slowly just changing all the sewer pipes.
Robin, I brought together six mayors from large and small cities around the United States 2.5 years ago, and I asked them the question. I said, since there are engineering solutions to fix these problems, and there frankly is a degree of money out there, the user fees and so on, why isn't this becoming an issue? The literal expression was, unless sewage backs up ankle deep into people's living rooms, there is no impetus to spend the money in the United States.
Well, and some would say, and we should point out, your company stands to benefit,
sure,
even more than it already does. You know, it's quite successful if everyone decides to invest this $1 trillion and replace these pipes or do some of the technological things that can be done to improve the systems.
We definitely stand to gain as a business from this, but so do roughly 100 other firms in the United States. So on the one hand, yes, my firm stands to gain. But that said, we're approaching this from a public policy standpoint, hoping that people will look at it not as necessarily taking care of our environment, but rather a health care issue. You know, if we take care of the water that we drink and that we swim in, we'll all be healthier. The second is a life cycle cost, which is to say, using an analogy, you spend $30 to change the oil in your car so that you don't have to replace the engine, and that's a life cycle analysis. And we in the United States need to wake up to the notion that even though it's a fairly large price tag, the cost of healthcare in America is skyrocketing, and that it well makes sense to spend some dollars on keeping people healthy by not allowing them to get sick. So there are some business arguments to be made. There are some humanitarian arguments to be made. I would just hate, to your point, for us to have to learn and fix this because we're standing in it. In some ways, we're living in, swimming in, drinking, fishing in, and surfing in our own effluence in the same way that people did 500 years ago, and that's unfortunate. I think we've been led to believe we live in a clean environment when the EPA would tell you just exactly the opposite.
Tom Rooney, President and CEO of Instruform Technologies, a company that repairs sewer pipes around the world. Tom, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Just a moment to remind you, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, as we just heard, when sewer systems get overloaded, the raw sewage ends up backing up into someone's house or dumped into a river or a lake or an ocean. Cities across the country, from here in Boston to Atlanta to Honolulu, are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to upgrade their sewer systems. In the Cleveland area, Frank Greenland is the Capitol's project director for the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District. He's crawled around in his fair share of sewer pipes as the district invests $819 million to upgrade those pipes. Welcome, Frank.
Hello.
Well, we just heard from Tom Rooney that sewer pipes are desperately in need of repair. Can you describe the condition of yours? I mean, you actually go down into them, don't you?
Yes, I've been down in the sewers, many of which were constructed well over 100 years ago.
And of brick, hand-laid brick, we understand, is in some of them?
Hand-laid brick, egg-shaped. I'm an engineer, so I'm pretty fascinated by them, but they were hand-laid, over 100 years old. They look like eggs in many cases. They're in surprisingly good condition in certain cases, and there are some issues in other cases since they are over 100 years old.
With some cracking, we understand, and we understand when there were heavy thunderstorms last summer, there was a great deal of flood damage in northern Ohio, and millions of gallons of raw sewage washed into tributaries and Lake Erie. Is that because the water runoff and the sewage is in the same pipe?
These are the oldest sewers that were built nationwide, and they're called combined because they take not only wastewater from your home or from industry, but they also take stormwater runoff from the streets and rooftops. They combine them in one pipe on their way to the treatment plant, and as the area grew, these pipes became overloaded. And many years ago, devices were built into the combined sewer system to allow them to overflow during significant rains, and that was done primarily to prevent basement and street flooding.
Well, so what are you doing? You know, you have a project to upgrade the sewer system. What are you doing?
There are really two components here. First, we need to make sure that the existing combined sewer system is functioning to the best of its capability, so we have significant rehabilitation and repair and cleaning contracts underway and will for till the end of time. I mean, these are old sewers, and they need to function well. The second and more major component into the future is our long-term combined sewer overflow control program, and what we will be doing and are doing today is constructing deep tunnel projects where we are building large diameter tunnels underground to drop the overflows that once went to the streams or to Lake Erie. We're dropping those overflows into the tunnel, holding those overflows in the tunnel till our wastewater treatment plants can accept those flows for full treatment.
Well,
that's a $2 billion endeavor.
I was just going to say, this is a lot of money. And as you know, the president is proposing cutting spending for the EPA. And as part of that, one of the biggest cuts would be cutting the program designed to help states and communities like yours update old sewer systems. So are you concerned that a city like yours, are you going to be able to do this? Are you going to be able to afford this?
Well, this is a challenge, not only locally, but nationally. When we look into the future, what do we see? We see a $2 billion program. Mm-hmm. We see really nothing on the horizon in terms of federal construction grants. So what happens? The burden of the federal mandates gets pushed onto our customers.
Well, we understand that this month the sewer district proposed rate increases of more than 60% for the suburbs, 75% for the city of Cleveland over the next 5 years. That's a lot of, you know, that's a big increase. And as we've been saying, people don't really think about their sewer lines.
Right.
You know, so how do you, you know, get them behind this?
Well, we're having a series of rate hike hearings now, which I've attended. And clean water comes with a price. The questions from the audience relate to the burden that's being imposed on low income, elderly. Where is the federal government in the equation? And what will the cost be in the future? And when we project 10 to 12% rate increases for the next 5 years, the question that's been raised is, and what about the next five? And in our minds, for the foreseeable future, that's 10 to 12% till the end of time, absent some changes. You know, I think there's a potential train wreck coming.
Frank Greenland, the Capital Projects Director for the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District, they're spending about $819 million to upgrade their sewer pipes there. Frank, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Min Young, it's here and now. The image of the chef, who's wildly emotional about his work, has long been a main course of many films. Take Anthony Shalhoub, the perfectionist chef Primo in the 1996 movie Big Night. He reacts in horror when his brother, played by Stanley Tucci, tells him to make pasta for a customer who's already ordered risotto.
How can she want? They both are starch. Maybe I should make a mashed potato for on the other side.
Primo, look, don't, okay? Because they are the first customer to come in 2 hours. The pipes
no. She's a criminal. I want to talk to her.
And the heat only gets turned up on reality TV. Fox's Hell's Kitchen features the badly behaved English chef Gordon Ramsay berating his charges as they compete for a job. He curses, throws meals at them, spits their creations on the floor. And Anthony Bourdain writes about the verbal abuse and drug use in kitchens in his tell-all book, Kitchen Confidential. But are chefs really all that out of control? Do they perhaps need a shrink? Joining us with his unique perspective is Here Now's foodie and when he's at home, practicing psychologist Scott Haas. Scott, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Nice to see you.
It just does seem to marry your vocation. You are a clinical psychologist, and your avocation as a food lover, this thinking about chefs.
They're very passionate people. And as a psychologist, you're very interested in passions, the passions that get in the way of success and the passions that lead to success.
And we need to rush to say that many chefs are an island of civility. You and I were talking about Patrick O'Connell
from the Inn at Little Washington.
Right. I was once in his kitchen and he turned, you know, chaos, trying to get the meals out. But he turned to his grill chef and said, "Grill chef, I believe you are on fire." And he said, "Sir, you are right. I am on fire." But it's not like that in other kitchens. How bad does it get?
I saw at Restaurant Danielle in New York, Chef Danielle Ballou, who is notorious. Not as much as it used to be, but notorious for really, you know, getting very angry because he knows how it's supposed to be. He knows the way it's supposed to look. And I've seen and heard him, you know, light into cooks who, not because they're doing a bad job, not because they're incompetent, but because they're just not doing it as fast or as competently as he is. Chances are you're not going to see blood flow. What Danielle Ballou said to me was, "I don't punch them anymore." So, you know, punch, you know, people have been hit. You got to remember, a lot of these cooks in their late 40s and 50s were trained in French kitchens, which were really like military setups, hierarchical. They would have apprentices there, and the apprentices were there at the whim of the head chef, and people were physically abused. This generation of cooks and chefs, through culinary institutes, through federal guidelines and so on, you don't see a lot of cooks getting hit anymore. I mean, that's not going to happen. But you got to remember, a lot of the older generation, that's how it worked.
Yeah. You know, sometimes there is crazy behavior in a kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But what do chefs tell you about that?
Chefs have been griping to me for years, and they're saying, "Scott, you know, we're not crazy people." You know, a lot of chefs now have, even if they only have one restaurant, many, many successful, the celebrity chefs, the typical celebrity chef has as many as 20 restaurants. Look at Wolfgang Puck. He's head of an empire that brings in gross $350 million a year. He has to be in control of his emotions. Chefs have told me, "We're not crazy people. We're like CEOs." I mean, is Larry Ellison crazy at Oracle? These are CEOs who run massive empires.
Well, and yet I want to ask you to put on both your hats, crowd mm-hmm. your head up there, mm-hmm. as a foodie, a little toque maybe up there, and as a psychologist. What would you say to the chefs just struggling to keep it together?
The main thing is you better learn to do what you're asked to do quickly and efficiently. It's not a lot different for a line cook than working on an assembly line. You have to do what the chef tells you. If there's no raisins in the chicken, don't think it's your turn to add the raisins and make the dish better. Do what the chef tells you to do. Show up sober. keep your relationships as best you can under control. It's a tough job. It's glamorized, but it's not what it appears to be on TV. That's for sure.
That's Scott Haas here now, foodie and also psychologist. When he's at home, he's been putting chefs on the couch for us today. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks much, Robin.
Thank you. Spanish chef Ferran Adria's restaurant El Bulli has garnered international acclaim with groundbreaking dishes such as olive oil caviar, Parmesan snow, and Rice Krispie paella. His cuisine was just one of those mentioned when Here Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst recently visited La Boqueria Market in Barcelona, Spain. She went with Daniel Bauza, the executive chef of L'Orangerie restaurant, and they began with the fish.
The thing that I'm noticing, first off, is it does not smell fishy.
It's so
there's
fresh.
None of that odor.
You can see the difference between a fresh fish or a not fresh fish. Looking at the eyes, look at this sea bass. If you touch this sea bass, it's a hard meat.
Firm.
Yeah, very firm. That means that it's very, very fresh.
I hear this woman's cleaning fresh squid.
Yes.
Taking the ink out.
Yeah, one of the typical plates here in Spain, it's the squids. We cook it with their own ink, and we do a sauce with this ink.
What is the flavor of the squid ink? How would you describe it? The sea.
It's the sea. It's like urinating sea. It's unbelievable. You know, sometimes people did a little bit like this because it gets very black, the plate.
The color, yeah.
The color,
yeah.
It's very, very black. And some of the people, they don't like this type of color, no? But if you try it, you're going to love it. It's amazing. It's very, very good. This
is one of the most incredible seafood you can get in Spain.
This is very, very expensive.
Yeah, I see, and very strange looking.
Yeah, percebes. The name in English, it's goat feet.
Goat feet.
Because reminds the feet of a goat.
Yeah.
Why it's so expensive? Because this grows only on the rocks close to the sea, and they're so difficult and so dangerous to get it, then it's for this thing they're so expensive.
To have this one of the most exquisite dinners that you can have. If you have this is the best, to have percebes. Yeah.
I can't even think of how to describe what this looks like. It looks prehistoric, a little phallic.
Yeah, exactly. It's difficult to describe
like
because...
Like a monster.
It's sea monster.
It's incredible, and then this is real a seafood.
The first man to eat this was very brave.
Exactly.
We're at the butcher shop here, and I see some very strange cuts of meat here. What are we looking at?
Here we have the insides of
the innards.
Yeah, the innards of the bill of pork. We can have here goat tongues. We have kidneys of bill. We have ears of pork.
What do you do with the ear of a pig?
You can eat it boiled, like on a stock. We have
lots of gelatin.
Yeah, lots of gelatin. Each region of Spain makes their own broth, and then you have the pigfoot, very 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 typical in Catalonia, and it's wonderful.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about Spanish food is it seems that Spanish food in general has become much more famous after El Bulli and, how do you pronounce his name, Fernan?
Ferran Adrià.
How has his experimentation affected you as a chef and what you cook?
Not much, but the good thing is that you learn a lot of things. I mean, the food right now, the cuisine, the Spanish cuisine, it has an evolution. And thanks to these guys, then they show you what you can do with the food.
So you see El Bulli and the fame of these experimental Spanish chefs as being very positive for everybody in Spain.
To everybody. It's very important. But not everybody, but a lot of restaurants, they try to do the same food than El Bulli, but it's wrong. They cannot do it.
Because they don't understand it.
They don't understand and they don't have the tools to do it. I mean, El Bulli has like 30 cooks on the kitchen. He has here in Barcelona a laboratory to do the experiments.
El Bulli is how far from Barcelona?
Like 1 hour, 50 minutes.
And you have to wait a year for a reservation.
Yeah, it's crazy. But you go to El Bulli to have an experience. It's not to have lunch or dinner only.
Like going to the moon.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the Twilight Zone.
That's Chef Daniel Bauza speaking with Here Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst at La Boqueria Market in Barcelona, Spain. For more information or to see pictures of Kathy's trip, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Bye. funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.